Phase 2 of the COVID origin study must be launched with terms of reference that are transparent, science-based, and give international experts the independence to fully assess the source of the virus and the early days of the outbreak.
Health and Human Services Secretary and former California Attorney General Javier Becerra telling the World Health Organization yesterday the United States wants to know more about where the coronavirus came from. Well, today, President Biden asked the intelligence community for a report within 90 days to determine whether COVID stemmed from a laboratory accident. Early on in the pandemic, the idea that the coronavirus escaped from a Chinese lab seemed like a far-fetched conspiracy theory. And for the most part, the media treated it like one, on par with maybe QAnon or faking the moon landing. Now, nearly 18 months after COVID appeared in Wuhan, and with still very little understanding of where it came from, we're taking the so-called lab leak idea more seriously. Some scientists are open to the idea, others reject it. We're going to talk about this now with two guests. First, let's talk with Betsy McKay. She covers U.S. and global public health for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's just talk about why we're talking about this now. Why are we now revisiting this idea of the origin story?
Well, you know, one big reason is that there was an attempt to find the origins, to search for the origins of the pandemic, led by the World Health Organization. And they came back with some answers, but a lot of unanswered questions. And one of the points of contention was that this team, you know, deemed the idea of a laboratory leak, quote, extremely unlikely, when in fact they really hadn't had much access to data or to the laboratories themselves, their records, their practices, to really draw that conclusion. And scientists afterwards started getting concerned.
So is there evidence at all that it could have come from a lab rather than from the wild, from a wild animal?
Right. I mean, that's the key question. And, you know, a group of leading scientists 2 weeks ago published a letter in a prominent academic journal and said, there's no evidence that proves either scenario, right? There isn't evidence yet to prove that this emerged and evolved into a human virus totally in the wild. And there's not enough evidence that shows that it leaked from a laboratory. And so scientific questions need to be pursued scientifically. And that means investigating both or other hypotheses to figure out what happened.
Well, let's talk about the arguments for each. What are the arguments in favor of the lab leak theory?
Well, so, you know, one of the main ones is very simple, which is that the first outbreak that led to this virus being discovered was in Wuhan, China. And these types of viruses haven't really been known to circulate in that part of China. They have been found in southern China, you know, really far away. And yet at the same time, here in this city in central China is a leading laboratory known around the world that studies coronaviruses from bats. And so it was just an obvious question. I mean, it was such an obvious question that the leading researcher at the Wuhan Institute of Virology asked herself the same question and went and did her due diligence and published some of it. But really, there isn't any proof right now beyond the kind of coincidence that they're in the same city. And, you know, what it really boils down to is, has the laboratory published or disclosed all of the viruses that it has and has worked with, or has it not? So on the other side is the natural evolution side. And the two aren't incompatible, by the way. The belief is that if a virus leaked from the laboratory, it came to the laboratory from someone gathering it somewhere in nature, right? Mm-hmm. But the natural evolution side, first of all, there is some evidence in the genetics of the virus that do suggest it evolved over time, you know, from bats to animals to humans. Secondly, this is kind of an accelerating trend around the world that over the past 40 years, infectious disease outbreaks that are caused by new viruses that have jumped from animals to humans, you know, the number of those outbreaks has grown dramatically. And so as part of that, in the past 17, 18 years, past two decades, two brand new coronaviruses evolved and jumped into humans from animals. One was SARS in 2002 and 2003 in China, and the other one is MERS in the Middle East. So there's a lot of evidence pointing in that direction. And you should say that many scientists believe that the natural evolution is the most likely scenario. They agree with the WHO about that, but also say that you can't just ignore the possibility that it could have, a virus very similar to this, to the pandemic virus, could have been in the laboratory and it could have escaped. And neither the lab nor the Chinese government are being open enough about it and disclosing enough information for anybody to draw a conclusion.
Okay, I want to bring in now Jonathan Chait, political columnist for New York Magazine, who has recently written a column highly critical of the media and how the media has covered this story. So initially, Jonathan, the media dismissed this idea, and that is chiefly because it was an idea, you write, promoted by then President Trump.
By President Trump and really in Tom Cotton, Senator Tom Cotton, a conservative Republican, even a little bit earlier than President Trump. The entire media didn't dismiss it out of hand. The New York Times was actually pretty cautious because I think its reporters understood that there was a lot of uncertainty and they understood it very quickly. But a lot of them just jumped feet first into the idea that this was a conspiracy theory and a lie. You had a lot of coverage. The Washington Post had pieces. National Public Radio had a national piece, somewhat more liberal organs like The Guardian and Vox and Slate, which were just ridiculing people who were raising this possibility by saying this was a false conspiracy theory. One of the problems was that some of the people who were making these claims were also making other somewhat related claims that were false and baseless. President Trump was saying that China deliberately released the virus somehow in the belief that infecting their own population would get around or hurting the United States, which was a pretty silly theory. And a lot of the coverage just blended these two theories together. But it was really a pretty bad show by the media.
I'm going to play a clip of tape from more than a year ago, and this is at a White House press conference. And the first voice we'll hear is that of John Roberts from Fox News.
Have you seen anything at this point that gives you a high degree of confidence that the Wuhan Institute of Virology was the origin of this virus?
Yes, I have. Yes, I have. And I think that the World Health Organization should be ashamed of themselves, because they're like the public relations agency for China.
And then John Roberts follows up. He asks Trump what exactly gives him that degree of confidence that it originated in the lab. And Trump said, I can't tell you that. So is that also part of it, that the Trump administration wasn't really forthcoming with the proof that it thought that it had possibly really escaped from the lab?
Absolutely. There was a massive credibility problem because President Trump just lies on a scale far beyond any other politician that we've ever dealt with in American politics. So there's an inherent credibility problem and an inherent skepticism to any claim he makes, and especially when he's saying, oh, I've seen it, I have the evidence, you'll find the evidence, you'll hear the evidence. He just makes that stuff up all the time. So it was appropriate to treat his claims with skepticism and not treat them as if they were true. There's some sympathy that I think reporters should get about dealing with the uncertainty there. But they went way beyond saying we have no proof here and went straight from that to this is a lie. We know this is false. We know this is a conspiracy theory, which they never really had a sound basis to say.
Right. But it's kind of like the boy who cries wolf. So the initial skepticism is there because of so many other instances where
There's fault to be shared. I don't think anybody's takeaway from this is that we should give Donald Trump more credence and we should really listen to that guy the next time he tells us something. But I do think the media has an obligation, even in the face of such a dishonest president, to try to sort fact from fiction and not just immediately go to calling it false just because he says it's true.
And so, Betsy, you heard there in that clip, President Trump was criticizing the WHO. as a public relations agency for China. And we began this discussion saying that people, scientists, credible scientists, are now critical of how the WHO handled this investigation. So in that respect, is Trump right about the ability of the WHO to carry out a credible investigation?
Well, not entirely. First, a couple things. One is that the WHO convened this group, but it was an independent group of scientists. I mean, they came to their own conclusions. And secondly, the day they published their report, the WHO director general himself came out and said, I don't agree with all of this report's conclusions. I think the lab hypothesis needs to be investigated further. That report, again, had said the lab hypothesis was extremely unlikely. So, you know, it wasn't the World Health Organization itself. The WHO has been criticized for kind of, you know, not standing up to China, certainly in the beginning of the outbreak. You know, one thing that's always important to remember about the WHO is it doesn't actually have any power over sovereign governments. It can't say, China, you do this, or China, you do that, or China, we're sending in experts to figure out how this pandemic started. It doesn't have any legal authority to do that. It relies on diplomacy.
So it has to hope that China is an honest partner in providing the data it needs to carry out the investigation.
Yeah, this is a weak point in global health law and regulations, and it's something that actually governments are working on and talking about this week, is how do you get governments to disclose outbreaks and to cooperate with investigations or studies into what happened and to start an outbreak, you know, when there's concerns about blame and, you know, effects on their economies and stuff. It's an ongoing problem. And, you know, very often these epidemics and outbreaks start in countries that don't want to let the world in. I think we have to look at ourselves as well. You know, do we really want anyone stomping around our laboratories in this country? I mean, it's kind of a natural instinct. The other thing I would say about President Trump putting that out there a year ago, that, you know, we have evidence, and Secretary Pompeo as well, is that for months this went on. You know, we have evidence that there was a lab leak in Wuhan, but no evidence disclosed. And there have been calls to declassify and make that evidence public ever since. In the waning days of the Trump administration, literally January 15th, the State Department suddenly published a fact sheet that the U.S. has information that several laboratory workers were sick in the autumn of 2019 before the first known cases of COVID-19, which was in December 2019. So they finally threw that out there as they were about to leave office. And my own colleagues published a couple of days ago some more details on that intelligence, which is that three employees of the Wuhan Institute of Virology were sick enough to have to be treated in a hospital. But to this day, the information that the U.S. has not been declassified and made public. So we still don't know how President Trump came to his conclusions or what the U.S. government knows today.
Well, hopefully we'll know more after this investigation that President Biden has ordered. Betsy McKay covers U.S. and global public health for The Wall Street Journal. Jonathan Chait writes for New York Magazine. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the long emotional tale of this past year, why getting the vaccine might not make us instantly happy. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, here in the United States, the worst days of the pandemic appear to be over. A lot of us are trying to return to some semblance of our normal lives. But the sum total of these past 14 months has been astonishing. nearly 600,000 Americans dead, more than 33 million infected, and our way of life totally upended for, well, these past 14 months. So now, with the constant fear of infection melting away, we should be feeling a big weight lifting, a feeling of relief, of excitement, joy even. But that's not happening for some people, or for maybe most of us. Ed Yong wrote about the long mental and emotional tale of this disease recently in The Atlantic, and he joins us now. Welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
It's so great to have you back. And I just want to quote a line from your piece. You wrote, if you've been swimming furiously for a year, you don't expect to reach dry land and feel like you're drowning. So why do so many of us feel like we're still drowning when we are, you know, on dry land?
This is actually very common. Like often when disasters strike and people are constantly stressed or fearful or anxious, you know, the adrenaline helps you to get through the worst of it. And it's only later when you get a chance to exhale, when you get a moment of calm and reflection, that you realize how bad you feel, that you are able to actually grapple with the grief and the stress and the hurt of everything that has gone before. And so it's no surprise that actually at that point, a lot of people crumble. They find those moments unexpectedly difficult. And all the more so if they weren't expecting it. Like you said, you know, a lot of us are expecting to get out into the world now that things are a little bit better and feel joy. But it turns out that when things start feeling better, people don't necessarily immediately feel better themselves.
Right. So one expert that you quote says, as hard as the initial trauma is, it's the aftermath that destroys people. And I can understand that. I can understand the adrenaline that you speak of and the living in the present. Is it also the fact that once we emerge, we have to sort of actually plan for a future that we don't really understand? And is that part of it too? We've been so furiously living in the present and just trying to get through the day that once, now that we're faced with a new future, that in itself is also traumatic?
I think so. You know, the pandemic in many ways was a huge challenge to our ability to make sense of the world around us. You know, many of the things that we loved and relied upon, close contact with friends and family, you know, going out into public spaces, being part of communities, all of those things were upended. They felt dangerous and rightly so. So a lot of us had to establish new routines for how to go about living our lives. And much of America took up wearing masks, a thing that they never had done before. And now, as things become a bit safer and calmer, it's not that people are just going to snap back to how they lived in 2019. A lot of what they'll have to do now involves once again reestablishing their sense of what is dangerous, what is safe, what is the right way to live in the world. And doing that wholesale reimagining of the world and the way you live in it is already challenging enough, let alone having to do it for the second time in as many years after 14 months of stress and pain and hurt.
Mm-hmm. Which explains why some people don't want to shed their masks, even if they are fully vaccinated and even if the CDC says it's okay to do so. They almost feel like a security blanket.
Yeah, I think this is completely understandable. Like, people don't make decisions about the present moment as if they were living in a vacuum. You also learn from what's happened in the past. And we've come out of this year, you know, seeing repeatedly that supposedly august institutions can sometimes get things wrong, that leaders who supposedly were meant to have our backs often abandon us, and that it's difficult sometimes to rely on other people to act for the collective interest. Like, a lot of Americans refuse to act in that way. And so absent all of those things, what do we have? Well, masks were part of it, right? As one psychiatrist said to me, you know, no one was protecting us all year. We had masks. That's how we protected ourselves. So no wonder people are a bit anxious about taking them off. And I think we should try our best to be empathetic and give people time. You know, it's not like the pandemic is now over and everything snaps back to normal. Even for people who have been vaccinated, who've been privileged enough to have that safety, it might take a long time to readjust to that sense of safety.
And then, of course, there are people who have lost so much, people who have lost family members, people who have lost jobs, and people like doctors and nurses who had to face death every single day when they went to work. And that's a whole other issue that won't be solved soon.
I agree. You know, let's take just two of those things you mentioned. One is the people who've lost loved ones. So as you said, there are 600,000 recorded deaths from the pandemic in this country. Roughly 9 bereaved people will be grieving each of those deaths. So that's almost 6 million people. And we know that about 1 in 10 people under normal circumstances still experience really intense, prolonged grief for more than a year after it begins. They just can't seem to get over that grief. They can't get past the loss of a loved one. That's going to be the population of a city like Atlanta in that category. And that's huge. That's an immense burden of grief that this country will have to shoulder. And then, as you said, there are other people, like caregivers, people whose job involves looking after the rest of us, like healthcare workers, who will be struggling with all of the traumas they have personally witnessed. Healthcare workers also aren't just going to get a break, right? It's not like vaccinations rising and healthcare workers get to go on holiday. They all have to then pick up the slack from the work that didn't get done when COVID was filling emergency rooms and ICUs. So their traumas are nowhere even near over. And we know from past outbreaks, like from the original SARS, that healthcare workers, many of them develop PTSD sometime after their experiences. And that was a epidemic that was reasonably small and was over in a few months. So imagine what something on the scale of COVID is going to do for this workforce of people who we rely upon to look after us.
Is there any kind of help for those people being prepared right now? Is there any kind of initiative to address what you're talking about, this large-scale PTSD and mental health crisis?
I mean, I think that this is the right time to try to have these conversations, to acknowledge the scope of the future suffering, and to try and set up the systems in that will look after people. You know, I think that it's going to be hard. I don't want to sound too pessimistic about it, but some of the people I spoke to were a little pessimistic about it, because mental health care in the US was already essentially a broken system. There weren't enough people providing that care and support. It was really very hard for people, even with resources, to access help. And now the demand is going to be much higher. The system is going to be stressed even further. And, you know, regrettably, this is not a country that I think does very well at dealing with and talking about loss and grief. And this is part of why I wanted to write this piece. I wanted to at least name and acknowledge the fact that people are going through this right now. And so if any listeners feel seen by what we've talked about, you know, if any of our listeners right now feel like they're still struggling, even though they expected to be better, I can only say that, firstly, this is completely normal. And also, you're not alone. And I'm hoping that is the first step to having some sort of resolution, to at least communally acknowledge the shared traumas that we've gone through and that will continue lingering even as vaccination rates rise.
How long do you think we'll be dealing with the after effects, do you think?
I don't know. And I think that the hard thing about that question is that it will vary substantially from person to person. So some people won't go through any of what we've just talked about. Some people will be fine. You know, you'll get vaccinated, you'll go back out into the world, you'll live your lives. And if that's you, then fantastic. I actually genuinely feel very happy for you. I think that we need to think about the people who'll be left behind. And we know that the people I've talked to who study the sociology of disasters say that the recovery period from disasters is measured in years, maybe even decades. It's not a matter of going away in weeks or months. I think that COVID-19 will define stuff that will affect us for a generation, maybe more.
Oh, wow. Ed, it's always great to speak with you. Thank you for coming on and being this compassionate voice
Thank
on this
you so
disease
much.
And this pandemic. I really appreciate that.
Always happy to talk.
That's Ed Yong. He's science writer at The Atlantic, where you can read his articles. And we want to hear from you. What is one thing from the pandemic that you are taking with you into a post-COVID-19 world? A good thing. Whatever it is, share that with us at kcrw.com/pressplay, or you can call us and leave a message at 424-538-8581, 424-538-8581. Coming up, could Amazon get any bigger? Why, yes. Yes, it can. It's buying a movie studio that owns the Bond movies and Rocky.
I just want to say one thing to my wife at home. Yo, Adrian! I did it!
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Rocky, James Bond, Legally Blonde, just a few of the 4,000 movies Amazon could soon own. It announced a plan today to buy MGM Studios for about $8.5 billion. Amazon would also get around 17,000 TV shows like The Handmaid's Tale, Fargo, even The Apprentice. Here to tell us more about this is Matt Bellany, former editor at The Hollywood Reporter and regular contributor to KCRW's The Business. Hi, Matt.
Hi there.
Well, I guess people have been anticipating that eventually a big tech company would buy a major Hollywood studio. So, of course, it would be Amazon.
Yeah, Amazon and Apple have been the two that have been rumored for a couple of years now. Amazon supposedly looked at MGM a few years ago, and ultimately they decided not to do that deal, and the value has only gone up. I mean, this deal for $8.5 billion is a big premium on what most people think MGM is worth, but to Amazon, it makes sense. I mean, they're trying to compete in the streaming future. And this is mm-hmm. a big, big asset to be able to compete with Netflix and Disney and the others.
Well, talk about that asset. What does MGM have that makes it so attractive?
It's got a library. And when you are trying to build a service that becomes a habit for people, where you're going to go back over and over again, you have two options. You can either create that content yourself, or you can license or buy it. And Amazon has in the past licensed movies, and they've done their own originals, but they are not on the level of the old school studios like Disney or even NBC Universal, where they have decades of content that they have in their library. And they're not like Netflix, which has been spending tens of billions of dollars over the past decade to build its own original library. They needed to get in the game, and they saw this asset that was available, so they now have access to all of these titles. They don't have it all. A lot of the MGM films, especially the glory days of the Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind, those were previously sold off, but they do have about, as you said, 4,000 titles, and that's got a lot of good stuff in there.
Like what? Like James Bond? I mentioned that.
Yeah, I mean, Bond is the big one, but Bond comes with its own complications. MGM only owns 50% of Bond, and it doesn't control the creative output. The creative output of the franchise is controlled by the Broccoli family, which is the original rights holders to the Ian Fleming estate's film rights. So that's why you've never seen a James Bond television show, because the Broccoli family doesn't want to do one, or they haven't in the past. They only want to make big theatrical James Bond movies every few years. They control the casting, they control the script, they control everything. And it's been very frustrating for MGM, because we are living in a day of franchises. And if, you know, all the other franchises are spinning off into sequels and TV shows and video games and all the other stuff, James Bond is this huge franchise, and they haven't been able to exploit it. So we'll see what Amazon does with the Broccoli family, but that is a limited franchise.
Okay. So it's also got, as I mentioned, the Rocky franchise. What else?
You mentioned Legally Blonde. There's some horror franchises in there. There is, you know, a lot of dramas from the 90s. You know, you mentioned Fargo and Handmaid's Tale. Those shows are successful because those were based on movies in the MGM library that they successfully turned into television shows. So they must be looking at some of these older titles. Look at something like The Thomas Crown Affair or Poltergeist. Those are two movies that are in the MGM library, and they've already said that they may want to reboot them in some fashion. That's what Amazon is looking at here, because in this streaming universe, you're trying to distinguish yourself, and pre-branded franchises are really the best way to get attention in this market.
Right. So you want people watching over and over again, not just one movie in one sitting, but a lot of episodes.
Yeah, I mean, Look at what Amazon has done with the Tom Clancy franchise. They did a TV show, Jack Ryan, which is successful for them. And they recently aired a movie with Michael B. Jordan called Without Remorse that is based on the Tom Clancy universe. They bought that movie from Paramount because Paramount owns that. But they're looking at these as two big franchises that can appeal to that mass Amazon Prime Video subscriber that they want to bring into this universe and ultimately convince them to stay in the Amazon universe and spend more money buying other stuff.
Right. And so also TV titles. So 17,000, that's a lot. But also really including The Apprentice, that's interesting.
It is interesting because about 5 years ago, MGM purchased Mark Burnett's company. Mark Burnett, the famous creator of Survivor and the super producer behind The Apprentice and Shark Tank and The Voice, very successful in the past. But when they did that deal, they got his library as well. And as we know, Mark Burnett has become somewhat controversial because of his friendship with Donald Trump and, you know, the fact that he was very involved in creating this image of Trump as a deal maker and an important business person via The Apprentice. And there has always been rumors that there are tapes that Mark Burnett has of Donald Trump from his Apprentice days that might be damaging to the former president. So unless there's some deal we don't know about, Burnett could have carved it out or he may take those tapes back. We don't know the details, but it could end up where Jeff Bezos ends up having access to these Donald Trump Apprentice tapes.
Wow, that is revenge, a dish best served cold. Or at least digitally, perhaps. So does this vault Amazon into the Netflix realm?
Well, first of all, it's important to note that Amazon was pretty much already there when it comes to subscribers. There are about 200 million people that are Prime subscribers that have access to Prime Video. And Amazon announced recently that 175 million of those are looking at or viewing in some way the Prime Video content. We don't know how much. They may have tuned into one show and tuned it out. We don't know. But that is putting it on the level of Netflix in terms of overall subscribers. Netflix is at around 200 million as well. In the content race, Netflix has spent a lot more money on its original programming, and it is just going through the roof. An original movie every week, television shows, and all genres. And until recently, Amazon has been much more measured in the kind of content that it has done. It started out doing sort of independent art house fare in movies and a couple of shows that critics liked, like Transparent and The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, but not the kind of broad blockbuster style shows. In recent years, they have tried to pivot towards more of that. They bought the Coming to America sequel. They did Without Remorse, the Tom Clancy thing that I mentioned. On the TV front, they have a show called The Boys, which is a big, broad comic book style show produced by Seth Rogen that has been a big hit for them. So they're trying to align the content on Prime Video more with the general broad audience that comes to the Prime service. And that's probably a smart move. And I think MGM could help them in this because they have a bunch of movies that people have heard of.
All right, Matt, thank you.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany. He is former editor at The Hollywood Reporter and a regular contributor right here on KCRW's The Business. Coming up, actor David Diggs went from being a substitute teacher in the Bay to starring in Hamilton on Broadway. He is now on a couple of TV shows. We'll talk to him about his career next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, 6 years ago, actor David Diggs went from being a substitute English teacher in middle schools to starring on Broadway in Hamilton.
So he knows what to do in the trench, ingenuitive and fluent in French, I mean. So you're gonna have to use him eventually. What's he gonna do in the bench, I mean? No one has my resilience or matches my practical tactical brilliance. You want to fight for your land back? Give me my right hand man back.
Diggs played a dual role, appearing as both Thomas Jefferson and the Marquis de Lafayette. That won him a Tony and a Grammy, and from there, the job offers just rolled in. He has a recurring role on ABC's Blackish and Mixedish as Rainbow's brother, Johan.
The election's rigged.
He's what? Right. Why else do you think Bernie isn't the candidate?
Because Hillary got more votes.
Or did she?
She did.
Maybe that's just what they want you to believe.
Because it's the truth.
Whose truth?
On TNT, he plays a rebel in the post-apocalyptic drama Snowpiercer.
No one from First Class has ever been charged with a crime.
You should thank her for that. She keeps the borders tight. She keeps the rabble at bay. And she keeps First Class above the law.
And his 2018 film Blindspotting, which he co-wrote, produced, and starred in, has been turned into a series on Starz. And that debuts next month. David Diggs joins me now. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
It's nice to have you. All right, let's go back in time before all of this, all of what I just talked about, your current success in Hamilton and all that. And what was your life and career like before Hamilton, BH, I guess, in Oakland?
Yeah, after college, I went back to Oakland. And there's a really robust theater scene in the Bay Area. And so I came back and started auditioning and started doing that and also substitute teaching to make money. And then started doing some curriculum development with through a place called that is not around anymore, called the Marsh Youth Theater, that were sort of writing grants for me to develop spoken word based curriculum for middle school students in the Bay Area. And then I was also working with this organization, Youth Speaks. So doing a lot of arts education work and acting in plays and making rap songs.
Wow. So you were busy back then too.
Yeah. Yeah. Nothing is, it's funny, like me and, you know, Rafael Casal, who's sort of my co-conspirator in most things, we met or not met, but we started working together around that time too. It was like 2004. Uh-huh. And we say this all the time that like very little in terms of how we live our lives has changed, but just so many more people watch us do it now. But like the hustle feels almost exactly the same. I'm sitting in my recording studio right now. When we finish this, I have songs that are due. And and then I'll wake up early in the morning and be on set with Snowpiercer. So,
yeah. So you are very busy. And when you were growing up in Oakland, were you a creative kid? Were you in theater productions in like elementary school and things like that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. All the school plays. Well, starting in I guess, seventh grade, all the middle school plays and all the high school plays. I was so at Berkeley High School, there were plays in the fall and then in the spring it was musicals. But I was always running track in the spring. So I had to do the plays in the fall and then run in the spring. So I never did a musical until Hamilton. But yeah, no, I didn't really like singing in front of people.
but you majored in theater arts at Brown, right?
Yeah, I love acting, but Broadway has never really appealed to me that much, particularly not in a musical. But I thought, you know, maybe I'd find a way to make it into a straight play that went, but I didn't know how to do that. Like, I didn't know. We're so far removed from that in the Bay Area. Like, it wasn't really part of my imagination, you know? Uh-huh. I don't think I even ever saw a show on Broadway until I was doing workshops for Hamilton.
Huh.
I think. Yeah.
And so here you were doing really small theater productions and, you know, small performances by comparison in the Bay Area, and then all of a sudden you're on Broadway. Was that a culture shock for you?
It was. It wasn't really all of a sudden. You know, between that, I moved to Los Angeles. I was on tour. You know, when we were workshopping Hamilton, I was on tour with a show called Word Becomes Flesh. It was like a choreo poem that Mark Bamuzzi Joseph wrote. And my band Clipping was on tour. And I just assumed they'd replace me by the time they went to Broadway, because they had a lot of, you know, seasoned Broadway veterans who were friends of theirs. But then that didn't happen. And so, yeah, so then I was on Broadway kind of navigating that whole world, which is a trip. It's not, yeah. It's its own existence. You know what I'm saying? It's its own ecosystem. Mm-hmm. It's like a lot of the hardest working, most talented artists I've ever been around, but it also is so blind to the outside world. It thinks that way more people care about it than do, you know?
Right. I know what you mean, because, and you've won a Tony, but I think the Tony Awards, it's always been a little perplexing to me.
It's wild, right? Because it celebrates roughly 12 blocks of theater. If you're not really checking for it, you don't know any of that stuff, you know, which is why a Hamilton is such a weird phenomenon, right? Like, that just doesn't happen, that mm-hmm. shows on Broadway become kind of cultural, like popular culture. It's rare.
A phenomenon, a popular culture earthquake, really.
Yeah.
And you're a part of it. Do you sometimes disassociate and think, gosh, this is me? What am I? Wow.
I don't know. You know, the whole process was so similar to everything I've ever done. Those so many, uh-huh. because of I was in Freestyle of Supreme, like, those are all my friends. So it was just making stuff with my friends, which is the same thing I've always done. I'm very fortunate to have very brilliant friends in my life, and we like to make art projects together. And Hamilton really, like, at the end of the day, felt like one of those. It was super weird that so many people wanted to see it, to me. But awesome. It's like sort of the dream of what you always think when you're making stuff with your friends. It's like, oh, it'd be crazy if anyone ever was going to see this, but they probably won't. You know?
Right. And I guess that's the same thing with Blindspotting, right? You wrote it with your friend, Raphael Casal, way before Hamilton and all that. And then it became a movie in 2018. But it was on the shelf for a while, right?
Yeah. Well, we just couldn't, you know, we were... Our producers, Jess and Keith Calder, were attached to it from the beginning, and sort of we wouldn't have made it without them. They found Raphael through his poetry on on YouTube, and asked him if he wanted to write a movie. And he said, yeah, but only with my friend Diggs. That was sort of this 10-year journey of us learning how to write a movie, thinking we had a draft that was like a good idea, and trying to figure out how to shoot, you know, attaching directors to it and going on scouts up in the Bay, and then just like the funding falling apart or the interest dissipating or whatever. It took 10 years to write that movie, in part because it was hard to get produced, but also because it took us that long to learn how to write a good movie.
I guess it gives comfort to people who are trying to live a creative life and not bow to the pressures of commercialism, that, you know, it can work both ways. Do you see it that way? Or do you see that maybe the bigger that you get and the more successful you get, the less creative you can be?
No, I mean, just because something is commercial doesn't mean it's not creative. I think it's difficult sometimes to attach big price tags to things when it's uncertain. And so part of what I enjoy of it is the not knowing if it's going to work. I like to do projects that I think are big swings, because that's what's exciting about it. If I'm sure about it, if it seems like a formula that we really know, like, I love watching a lot of stuff like that, you know, but I have less fun working on it. But yeah, you know, I mean, being an artist is just you. If a check presents itself and you need a check, you should take the check. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't have this, like, no, you got to suffer for your art. And so I would take the check probably and then use that money to, like, not stress for the next few weeks so you can make better art. It's really hard to make good things when you're stressed out.
Yeah.
There's just a balance, and the whole hustle is trying to find that balance of, and understanding it, and that it keeps changing as you get older and your values keep shifting, you know, and just allowing yourself to be a person who's whose needs and wants and values change over time is a tricky thing, because so much of what you sell as an artist, particularly as a performer, is yourself.
Yeah. Is that something that you were thinking of when you thought about how to play Frederick Douglass? You're playing him in the series The Good Lord Byrd. And of course he had a massive public persona and also had his own private self. So is that something that you were thinking about, like how to balance those two?
It was absolutely for me the thing that I locked into. I think that allowed me to find my take on that on him, you know. Reading a bunch of his autobiographies and just reading everything I could get about him, like that was the thing that stuck out to me, was that here's a brilliant man who is mining his past, creatively mining his past in order to rally people around this idea of emancipation and for financial gain. And mm-hmm. so that was the thing I could all of a sudden really relate to. Yeah, having a very, very public persona and the trickiness of navigating that and the value of that, how much good he can do as this very public person, and how at odds that can be sometimes with what he wants to do, maybe. You know, the scene where he tells John Brown that he's not going to fight with him is so heartbreaking to me, because he loves this man and clearly mm-hmm. and like struggled with it so much. Frederick Douglass later wrote, I think we put it in the over the end credits, he wrote, I was willing to die for, or to live for the slave. John Brown was willing to die for him.
But he also is portrayed, and this is I guess how James McBride wrote him in the novel, as a very flawed human being.
Yeah.
And kind of a randy, unlikable human being, I guess, in certain cases.
Yeah, well, I mean, a human being who is experiencing all the trappings of extreme wealth and fame. Mm-hmm. And a man who lives on the road most of the time. And, like, I think flawed, I suppose, but it depends on where you put your values, right? What he felt like to me is, like, a very real human being.
Yeah, I see what you mean. So here you are playing all these historical figures. Did you ever see yourself doing that?
No, I didn't say I didn't. I don't
great
have like
men
a,
of history.
Yeah, I just have a mood board in my room with like a bunch of.
Who's next? Who's the next?
A bunch
great
of historical
man?
Figures. Yeah, man, just magazine cutout articles on corkboard. I throw darts to see which one I'm going to play next. No, it's pretty funny. I certainly never. Yeah, I didn't think that was in the cards for me. You know, I don't even remember what I was auditioning for, but I remember auditioning for something. The director at the time telling me that, like, I just wasn't a good fit for history pieces. You know, like I was just too contemporary.
What does that mean? Is that like code?
I don't know. I was young but also like, I don't know what it means still to this day, but I still remember that. And so I think maybe that has something to do with why I never thought I would play historical figures.
Well, you are playing Sebastian in The Little Mermaid. Is he? Was
yeah,
he
yeah.
On the dartboard?
He was not.
Is he a historical figure? Also, I don't know.
Also, I mean, I guess so. He's. I certainly grew up on The Little Mermaid. I was certain that wasn't coming my way. And I wasn't going to go in for the audition. My team very wisely were like, just go. Like, it was the day of, and I hadn't looked at the material, but I, you know, I know the material. So it's The Little Mermaid.
Right.
That wasn't really a problem, but I was driving around LA and I was like, I don't want to do that. I think I'm not going to do this. And they were like, just go do this one. And I had so much fun in the audition that, like, I all of a sudden after it, I was like, oh no. Oh my God. I really hope this happens. I would like
oh,
to
really?
Do more. Yeah.
So this is a live action movie, right?
Yes, it is. It is. Sebastian is. I'm not sure what I'm allowed to say about this, honestly.
Are you in a crab costume? I just want to.
I am not in a crab costume. I'll give you that. Which I don't know if that's better or worse for people, but it's. It is for the best. I think the movie is more beautiful because of it.
that you're not in a crab costume? I don't know.
That I am not in a crab costume.
Okay.
I can pull off a lot of things, but I
think, crab costume is not one of them.
Maybe not one of them.
Wow. Well, David, it has been a pleasure having you on the show. Thanks for coming on.
It's great talking to you. Thanks for having me.
That's David Diggs and his show Blindspotting debuts on Starz June 13th. And that'll do it for us today. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.